I studied the nearest one a little more closely, drawn to it. It was a relaxed, feminine face with a soft smile. The woman looked as peaceful as if she was asleep. A heavy sickening swelled in my gut. It was La Connue de la Seine, the famous French death mask. Jax had a replica in the den. He said the woman was beautiful, that she'd been a bohemian obsession in the late 19th century. Eliza had made him cover it with a sheet, much to his distaste. She said it gave her the creeps. I looked slowly around the room. All of the faces, the people, they were death masks. I only just stopped myself from gagging. Nishira didn't just collect voyant spirits. She collected their faces, too. Seb. What if Seb was up there? I forced myself to look down, but my stomach roiled. You seem unwell, Nishira said. I'm fine. I am pleased to hear it. I would hate for you to fall ill at this crucial stage of your time in Sheol One. She traced her dinner knife with a gloved finger, still looking at me. My red jackets will join us in a few minutes. But I wish to speak to you first, a little heart to heart. It fascinated me that she thought she had a heart. The blood consort has kept me informed of your development. He tells me he has tried his utmost to bring out your gift, she said. But you have failed to achieve full possession of a dreamscape, even an animal dreamscape. Is this true? She didn't know. It's true, I said. A pity. Yet you faced one of the Emim and survived, even wounded the creature. For that reason, Arcturus believes you should be made a red jacket. I didn't know what to say. For whatever reason, Warden hadn't told her about the butterfly, or the deer. That meant he didn't want her to know about my abilities. But he did want me to be a red jacket. What was he playing at this time? How quiet you are, Nishira observed. Her eyes were glacial. You are not quite so timid at the oration. I was told I should only speak when required. You are required now. I wanted to tell her where to stick her requirements. I'd been insolent with Warden. I shouldn't think twice about doing the same to her. But her hand still lay on the knife, and her fixed gaze held no qualms. Finally, trying to sound suitably abased, I said, I'm happy the blood consort thinks me worthy of a red tunic. I've tried my best in my tests. No doubt. But let us not be complacent. She sat back in her chair. I have some questions for you. Before your inaugural feast.
Inaugural?
Yes. Congratulations, 40. You are a red jacket now. You must be introduced to your new associates, all of whom are loyal to me, even above their own keepers. Blood pounded in my ears. Red jacket. Bone grubber. I'd reached the highest echelons of Sheol One, the inner circle of Nishira Sargas. I wish to speak to you about Arcturus. Nishira looked into the fire. You have been keeping quarters with him. I have my own room, on the upper floor. Does he ever ask you to come out of it?
Only for training.
Nothing else at all? Perhaps some light conversation?
He has no interest in talking to me, I said.
What could I say that would be of any concern to the blood consort?
An excellent point. I bit my tongue.
She had no idea how much I interested him, how much he taught me under her nose. I imagine you have explored his quarters. Is there anything in the Founder's Tower that troubles you? Anything out of the ordinary?
He has some plant extracts I don't recognize.
Flowers. When I nodded, she took something from the table. A brooch, barely tarnished by the years, shaped just like the flower on his snuffbox. Have you ever seen this symbol in the Founder's Tower?
No.
You seem very sure.
I am sure. I've never seen it.
She looked straight at me, into my eyes. I tried to hold her gaze. A door closed in the distance. A line of red jackets walked into the room, escorted by a male ref I didn't recognize. Welcome, my friends. Nishira beckoned them. Please, sit. The ref pressed a fist to his chest and left the room. I scanned the human faces. 20 bone grubbers,
each well-fed and clean as a whistle. They must come in groups. The veterans from Bone Season 19 were at the front. Catherine was there, as were 16 and 17. At the back of the line was Carl, clad in a red tunic, his hair combed and parted. He stared at me with wide, reproachful eyes. He must never have seen a pink jacket at the Blood Sovereign's table. They all took their seats. Carl was forced to sit in the only available chair, the one opposite me. David sat down a few places away. There was a fresh cut on his head, sealed with a row of Steri-strips. He looked up at the death masks with raised eyebrows.
"I am pleased you could all join me tonight. Thanks to your continued efforts, there have been no notable Emmite attacks this week."
Nashira looked at each of them in turn.
"Having said that, we must not forget the constant threat of the creatures. There is no cure for their brutality, and, thanks to the broken threshold, no way in which to imprison them in the netherworld. You are all that stands between the hunters and their prey."
They nodded. They all believed it. Well, maybe not David. He was looking at one mask with a slight smile. I caught Catherine's eye across the table. A massive bruise wept down one side of her face. 16 and 17 didn't even glance at me. Good. If they looked at me, I might not be able to stop myself chucking a dinner knife at them. Liss was still outside, dying, all because of them.
22. Nashira turned to the bone grubber on her right. "How is 11? I understand he is still at Oriel."
The young man cleared his throat.
"He's a little better, Blood Sovereign. No sign of infection." "His bravery has not gone unnoticed. He will be honored to hear it, Blood Sovereign."
"Yes, Blood Sovereign. No, Blood Sovereign." Refs did love a good ego stroke. Nashira clapped her hands again. Four Amarotics came through a small door, each carrying a platter and the overpowering smell of herbs. Michael was among them, but he didn't meet my eye. Working quickly, they laid a magnificent spread on the table, all around the bell jar. One poured chilled white wine into our glasses. A lump blocked my throat. The platters were laden with food. Beautifully cut chicken, tender and succulent with crispy golden skin. Stuffing with sage and onion. Thick, sweet-smelling gravy, cranberry sauce. Steamed vegetables and roast potatoes. And plump sausages wrapped in bacon. A feast fit for the Inquisitor. When Nashira nodded, the bone grubbers tucked straight in. They ate quickly, but without the feral urgency of starvation. My gut ached. I wanted to eat, but then I thought of the Harleys, living on grease and hard bread in their hovels. So much food in here, and so little out there. Nashira noticed my reservation. "Eat." It was an order. I put a few slices of chicken and some vegetables on my plate. Carl gulped down his wine like it was water.
"Watch it, one," said one of the girls. "You don't want to be sick again."
The rest of them laughed. Carl grinned.
"Come on, that was just once. I was still pink."
"Yeah, come on, leave off, one. He deserves the wine."
22 gave him a friendly punch on the arm.
"He's still a rookie. Besides, we all had a tough time with our first buzzer."
There were murmurs of assent.
"I passed out,"
the same girl admitted. A selfless display of solidarity.
"The first time I saw one, I mean."
Carl smiled.
"But you're great with spirit, Six."
"Thanks." I watched their camaraderie in silence. It was nauseating. But they weren't acting. Carl didn't just like being a red jacket. It was more than that. He belonged in this strange new world. I could empathize in a way. It was how I'd felt when I first started working for Jackson. Maybe Carl had never found a place in the Syndicate. Nashira watched them. She must take pleasure in this weekly charade. Stupid indoctrinated humans, laughing about the trials she'd put them through, all under her thumb, eating her food. How powerful she must feel. How self-satisfied.
"You're still a pink."
A high-pitched voice came to my attention.
"Have you fought a buzzer?"
I glanced up. They were all looking at me. "Yesterday night," I said.
"I haven't seen you before." 22 raised his dense eyebrows. Whose battalion do you fight in?
I'm not part of a battalion. I was enjoying this.
You must be, another boy said. You're pink. Which other humans are in your residence? Who's your keeper?
My keeper only has one human. I gave 22 a quick smile. You might have seen him around. He's the blood consort.
The silence stretched on for what seemed like hours. I took a sip of wine. The unfamiliar alcohol felt sharp to my tongue. It is well that the blood consort has chosen such a worthy human tenant as 40, Nishira said with a faint laugh. Her laugh was disconcerting, like hearing a bell that had struck the wrong note. She was able to fight the buzzer alone, without her keeper. More silence. I guess none of them had ever been into the woods without a ref escort, let alone try to fight a buzzer single-handed. 30 took the opportunity to voice exactly what I was thinking. You mean he doesn't fight the MM Blood Sovereign? The Blood Consort is forbidden from engaging with the MM. As my future mate, it would be inappropriate for him to do the work of Red Jackets. Of course, Blood Sovereign. Nishira was looking at me. I could sense it. I carried on eating my potatoes. Warden did fight the MM. I'd cleaned his wounds myself. He'd gone against Nishira, and she had no idea. Or if she did, it was just suspicion. For several minutes, only the clink of cutlery disturbed the silence. I ate my vegetables and gravy, still thinking of Warden's secret dealings with the MM. He'd never had to risk his life, yet he'd chosen to go out and fight them. There must be a reason. The Red Jackets talked in low voices. They asked each other about their residences, marveling at the beauty of the old buildings. Sometimes they slighted the Harleys. Cowards, really, even the nice ones. Catherine toyed with her food, flinching if the rookery was mentioned. 30 was still pink-faced, while Carl chewed with excessive force, alternating mouthfuls with a second glass of wine. Only when all the plates were cleaned did the Amarotics return to clear the table, leaving us with three dessert platters. Nishira waited for the Red Jackets to serve themselves before she spoke again. Now you are fed and watered, my friends. Let us have a little entertainment. Carl wiped the treacle from his mouth with a serviette. A troop of Harleys filed into the room. Among them was a whisperer. When Nishira nodded, he raised his violin to his shoulder and played a soft, lively tune. The others began to perform graceful acrobatics. To business, then, Nishira said. She didn't even look at the performance. If any of you have ever conversed with the Overseer, you may know what he does to earn his keep. He is my procurer for the bone seasons. For the last few decades, I have been attempting to procure valuable clairvoyants from the crime syndicate of Cyan London. No doubt many of you are aware of it. Some of you may even have been part of it. 30 and 18 both shifted in their seats. I didn't recognize either of them from the syndicate, but my work had been limited to 1-4 and occasionally 1-1 and 1-5. There were 33 other sections they could have come from. Carl was open-mouthed. Nobody looked at the performers. They had their art honed to perfection, and not one person cared. Sheol One seeks quality, not merely quantity. Nishira ignored the lowered gazes of half her audience. For the last few decades, I have noticed a steady drop in diversity among the clairvoyants we capture. All of your skills are respected and valued by the Rephaim, but there are many talents we still require to enrich this colony. We must all learn from each other. It would not do to simply take in card readers and palmists. 205940 is the kind of clairvoyant we now seek. She is our very first dreamwalker. We require sibyls and berserkers, binders and summoners, and one or two more oracles, any breed of clairvoyant that might bring fresh insight to our ranks. Catherine looked at me with her bruised eyes. Now she knew for certain that I wasn't a fury. I think we could all learn a lot from 40, David said, raising his glass. I'm willing. An excellent attitude, 12. And we do intend to learn a great deal from 40, Nishira said, turning her gaze on me. Which is why I will be sending her on an external assignment tomorrow. The veterans exchanged glances. Carl turned red as the strawberry Charlotte. I will also be sending 2059-1 and U-12, Nishira continued. Now Carl looked elated. David smiled into his glass. You will go with one of your seniors from Bone Season 19, who will keep an eye on your performance. 30, I presume I can count on you to do this. 30 nodded. I'd be honored, Blood Sovereign. Good. Carl was on the edge of his seat. What will the assignment involve, Blood Sovereign? We have a delicate situation to resolve. As 1 and 12 are aware, I have been asking most of the White Jackets to scry for the whereabouts of a group called the Seven Seals. They are part of the Clairvoyant Crime Syndicate. I didn't dare look up. The Seven Seals are known to be in possession of several rare clairvoyant types, including an oracle and a binder. In fact, the so-called White Binder is the key player of the group. From recent scrying attempts, we have deduced that they will be meeting in London the day after tomorrow. The place is called Trafalgar Square, within one cohort, and the meeting will be at 1 o'clock in the morning. The detail they'd accumulated was incredible. But with that many Voyans being used to scry at once, focusing all their energies in one section of the ether, I shouldn't have been surprised. It would produce a similar effect to a seance. Do any of you know anything about the Seven Seals? When no one replied, Nishira looked at me. 40. You must have been involved in the syndicate. If you were not, you would not have remained hidden in London for as long as you did. Her eyes played no games. Tell me what you know. I cleared my throat. The gangs are very secretive, I said. There's gossip, but...
Gossip,
she repeated. Rumors, I clarified. Hearsay. Elaborate. We all know their false names. And what might those be? The White Binder, the Red Vision, the Black Diamond, the Pale Dreamer, the Martyred Muse, the Chained Fury, and the Silent Bell. I knew most of those names. Not the Pale Dreamer. That suggests to me that there is another Dreamwalker. Isn't that a coincidence? Her fingers tapped the table. Do you know where they are based? I couldn't deny it. She'd seen my ID card. Yes, I said. In 1-4. I work there. Is it not unusual for two Dreamwalkers to live so close to one another? Surely they would have employed you too. They didn't know. I kept my head down, I said. The Dreamer is the Molisher of 1-4, the Binder's protege. She would have had me killed if she thought she had a rival. The dominant gangs don't like competition. She was toying with me. I was sure of it. Nishira wasn't stupid. She must have put it all together. The pamphlet, the Pale Dreamer, the Seven Seals working in 1-4. She knew exactly who I was. If the Pale Dreamer is a Dreamwalker, then the White Binder may well be hiding some of the most coveted clairvoyants in the Citadel, she said. It is rare that we have an opportunity to add such precious jewels to our crown. Your competence on this mission is vital, 40. If anyone is going to recognize the Dreamwalker from the Seven Seals, it is another Dreamwalker. Yes, Blood Sovereign, I said, my throat tight. But why are the Seven Seals meeting at this time? As I said, 40, this is a delicate situation. It seems that a handful of clairvoyants in Ireland are attempting to make contact with the London Syndicate. An Irish fugitive named Antoinette Carter is their leader. The Seven Seals will be meeting her. So Jax had pulled it out of the bag. I wondered how Antoinette had wormed her way into the Citadel. It was nigh on impossible to cross the Irish Sea. Voyans had tried to leave the country before, mostly heading for America, but few made it. You couldn't cross the ocean in a dinghy. Even if anyone had succeeded, Sine would never have let us hear of it. It is imperative that an analogous crime syndicate does not form in Dublin. Consequently, this meeting must be stopped. Your aim is to capture Antoinette Carter. I believe she, too, may be a rare type of clairvoyant, and I intend to find out exactly what power she hides. The second aim is to apprehend the Seven Seals. The White Binder is the critical target. Jackson, my mime lord. You will be supervised by the Blood Consort and his cousin. I expect results. I will hold you all responsible if Carter is allowed to return to Ireland.
Nishira looked at each of us, 30, David, Carl and I.
Is that understood?
Yes, Blood Sovereign,
30 and Carl said. David swilled his wine around the glass. I said nothing.
Your life here is about to change, 40. You will be able to use your gift, and to use it well on this assignment. I expect you to show gratitude for the long hours Arcturus has poured into your training.
Nishira looked away from the fire into my eyes.
You have great potential. If you do not attempt to reach that potential, I shall see to it that you never walk the sheltered halls of Magdalen again. You can rot outside with the rest of the fools.
There was no emotion in her gaze, but there was hunger. Nishira Sargas was losing her patience. Chapter 20. A Little World. The fifth and sixth members of our group were found in early 2057, the year after I joined. It was during a particularly vicious heat wave that they arrived. One of Jackson's couriers reported two new clairvoyants in 1-4. The pair had arrived as part of a tourist party for the annual summer conference at the university, which was always a great success. Eager young tourists were brought in by the hundreds from non-Sion countries, ready to be sent back as advocates for anti-clairvoyant policies. Such programs had already found support in some parts of America, where opinions over Sion had been divided for decades. The well-meaning courier had spied two auras and run straight to his mime lord, only to find out that the newcomers weren't permanent residents of 1-4. They had no idea that the syndicate existed. They might not even know they were voyant. The courier had reported that one of the two tourists, a young woman, was almost certainly a whisperer. Jax was unimpressed. Whisperers, he told me, were a kind of sensor, privy to the workings of the ether, the smells and sounds and rhythms of spirits. They could hear their voices and vibrations, even use them to play instruments. A pretty gift, he said, but by no means groundbreaking. Sensors were rarer than mediums, but not by much. The fourth order of clairvoyance. Still, there weren't many of them in the Citadel, and Jackson didn't like oddities. It was the other half of the pair that interested him. The courier had reported an unusual aura, caught between orange and red. The aura of a fury. Jax had been scouring the streets for a fury for years. But this was his first hopeful case. He couldn't believe his luck. He had a vision, a project. Jackson Hall didn't just want a gang. Oh no. He wanted a box of jewels. The creme de la creme of Voyant Society. He wanted the unnatural assembly to envy him above all other mime lords. I'll convince them to stay, he had said, pointing his cane at me. Just you wait, my Molisha. They have lives in their country, Jax. Families. I wasn't convinced. Don't you think they'll need time to consider it? No time for that, my dear. Once they leave, I'll never get them back again. They must stay. In your dreams. I don't dream. But shall we have a wager? He extended a hand. If you lose, you do two assignments with no pay. And polish my antique mirror. And if I win, I'll pay you double for the same assignments. And you won't have to polish my antique mirror. I shook his hand. Jackson had the gift of the gab. I knew exactly what my father would have said about him. Now there's a man who's kissed the Blarney Stone. There was something about Jackson that made you want to please him, to see that wild gleam leap to his eye. He knew he'd get the pair to stay. Having located their hotel and paid a busker to get their names, he sent them an invitation to a special event at a fashionable coffee house in Covent Garden. I delivered it to the concierge myself, in an envelope addressed to Miss Nadine L. Arnett and Mr. Ezekiel Sines. They sent their details back to us, half-siblings, both residents of Boston, the gleaming capital of Massachusetts. On the day of the interview, Jackson kept us updated by email.
Fabulous, oh this is fabulous. She is most definitely a hisser, very eloquent, fantastically rude too.
The brother intrigues me. Can't put a finger on his aura. Annoying.
Nick, Eliza, and I waited for another hour before the golden words came in.
They're staying.
Paige, the mirror requires elbow grease. That was the last time I bet against Jackson Hall. 2 days passed. While Eliza made room in the den for the newcomers, I walked with Nick to Gower Street to collect them. The idea was that they would just disappear off the radar, as if they'd been abducted and killed. We would leave clues. Some bloodied clothes, a hair or two. Sion would love it. They could use it to advertise more unnatural crimes. But most importantly, they wouldn't come after the missing siblings.
You really think Jack's convinced them to stay? I said as we walked.
You know what he's like. Jax could convince you to jump off a cliff if you'd listen to him long enough.
But they must have families. And Nadine is a student.
They might not have done well over there, Soot knows. At least Voynes can learn what they are in Sion. Over there they must just think they're crazy. He put on his sunglasses. In that way, Sion is a blessing. He was right, in a sense. There was no official policy in clairvoyance outside Sion. They had no legal recognition, no minority status. They only appeared in fiction. Still, that had to be better than being systematically hunted and killed like we were. I couldn't work out why they'd stay. They were waiting outside the university. Nick raised a hand to the nearest of the two.
Hi. Zeke?
The stranger nodded. I'm Nick. Paige, I said. Zeke's eyes were like black tea, set in a thin, restive face. He must have been in his 20s, slim for his height, with bristle wrists and skin used to the sun.
You're with Jackson Hall, right?
His voice carried an unfamiliar accent. He used his free hand to wipe the sweat from his brow, giving me a glimpse of a vertical scar.
Yes, but don't say that name again. The SVD could be anywhere.
Nick smiled. And you must be Nadine. He was looking at the Whisperer. She had her brother's eyes and restless features, but that was where the similarities ended. Her hair was dyed red, cut as if with a ruler. Sion Citadels tended to use the fashion and slang of the decade they were established. Everyone in Silo wore neutral threads, Victorian style. But Nadine's yellow shirt, jeans and stiletto screamed tourist and different.
Last I checked, she said.
Nick narrowed his eyes a little at Zeke. I was struggling to classify his aura too. Seeing it, Nadine moved closer to her brother.
What?
Nothing. Sorry, Nick said. He glanced over their heads, watching the university, before he looked at each of them in turn. We have to be quick. I take it you've both thought about this, because once you walk away from this building, there's no going back. Zeke looked at his sister. She looked at her shoes, arms crossed.
We're sure, he said. We've made our choice. Then let's go.
At the end of the street, the four of us piled into a buck cab. Nadine dug around in her bag and took out a pair of headphones. Without another word, she snapped them on and closed her eyes. Her lips seemed to be trembling. Monmouth Street, please, Nick said to the driver. The cab trundled off. Fortunately for us, buck cabs were unlicensed. They made plenty of push off the backs of their clairvoyant clientele. The place in Monmouth Street was where Jax lived, a three-story masonette above a small boutique. I often stayed overnight, telling my father I was staying with friends. It wasn't exactly a lie. For months I'd learned the ropes of clairvoyant society, the structure of the gangs, the names of their leaders, the etiquette and enmity between the sections. Now Jackson was testing my gift, teaching me how to be one of them. A few weeks after starting my new job, I'd been able to consciously crack my spirit out of place. I'd immediately stopped breathing. That was when Jax and Eliza had panicked, thinking they'd killed me. Nick, always the medic, had revived me with a syringe of adrenaline to the heart, and even though my chest had hurt for a week, I was proud as anything. The four of us had gone to Chatelaine's to celebrate, and Jax had ordered life support for next time. I fitted with these people. They understood the strangeness of my world, a world I was only just beginning to discover.
We'd created a little world in Seven Dials. A world of crime and colour. Now there was a stranger in our midst. Possibly two, if Nadine ended up being interesting. I felt for their dreamscapes. Nadine's was nothing unusual. But Zeke's, well, his was interesting. A dark, heavy presence in the ether. "So, Zeke," Nick said, "where are you from?" Zeke looked up.
"I was born in Mexico," he said, "but I live with Nadine now."
He gave no further explanation. I glanced over my shoulder.
"Have you been to a Cyan Citadel before?"
"No."
I wasn't sure if it was a good idea.
"But you came."
"We just wanted to get away for a while. Nadine's college was offering places on the conference. I was curious about Cyan."
He looked down at his hands.
"I'm glad we decided to come. We felt different for years, but, well, Mr. Hall told us why."
Nick looked intrigued. "What's the official stance on clairvoyance in the States?"
"They're calling it ESP, extrasensory perception. All they say is that it's a recognized illness under Cyan law, and that the CDC is investigating it. They don't want to commit to any stance on it. I don't think they ever will."
I wanted to ask about their families, but something told me to save it for later.
"Jackson's so pleased you're joining us," Nick offered a smile. "I hope you'll like it here."
"You'll get used to it," I said.
"I hated it when I arrived. It got better when Jackson hired me. The syndicate will take care of you."
Zeke looked up.
"You're not English?"
"Irish."
"I didn't think many Irish people escaped the Molly riots."
"I managed."
"It was such a tragedy. Irish music is beautiful," he added. "Do you know the writer song?"
"The one about Molly?"
"No, the other one. The one they sang at the end of the riots, when they mourned the dead."
"You mean An Ember Morning?"
"Yes, that's it."
He paused, then said,
"Would you sing some of it?"
Nick and I laughed at the same time. Zeke went red to the tips of his ears.
"Sorry, that was weird," he said. "I'd just love to hear it sung properly, if it doesn't bother you too much. I used to like listening to Nadine, but, well, she doesn't play anymore."
Nick caught my eye. A whisperer that didn't play music. Jackson would not be happy.
"Paige," he said gently. I realized Zeke was looking at me, waiting for an answer. I didn't know if I could sing the song. Irish music was forbidden in Cyan, especially Irish rebel music. I had a strong Irish lilt as a child, but out of fear of the spreading hibernophobia in Cyan, I dropped it when we moved away. Even at 8 years old, I could sense the strange looks people gave me when I pronounced something too oddly for their liking. I used to stand in front of the mirror for hours, copying newsreaders, until I'd cultivated a crisp English public school accent. I was still fairly unpopular. I was called Molly Mahoney for years, but eventually a small group of girls took me in, probably because my father sponsored the school dance. Perhaps I owed it to my cousin to remember. I looked out of the window and heard myself recite the song. "My love, it was an ember morning, when October was a-dawning. Fire cried on the honey meadow. Come, ghost of the vale, I am standing in the ashes where ye roam. Erin waits to bring you home. My heart, I saw a flame upon the sky when October's bitter morn was nigh. Smoke choked the honey meadow. Hark, spirit of the south, I am waiting near the cloven tree. Now Ireland's heart is broken by the sea." There were more verses, but I stopped abruptly. I remembered my grandmother singing it for Finn during the memorial service, the one we'd held in secret in the Vale. Just six of us. No body to bury. That was when my father announced his conscription, leaving my grandparents to face Cyan's military occupation of the south. Zeke looked grave. After a moment, Nick squeezed my hand. By the time we reached Monmouth Street, the cab was too hot to bear. I pressed some notes into the driver's hand. He handed one back to me. "For the pretty song," he said. "Bless you, love."
"Thanks." but I left it on the seat. I wouldn't accept money for a memory. I helped Nick unload the suitcases. Nadine stepped out of the cab and pulled off her headphones. She gave the building a withering look. Her bag caught my eye. From a New York designer. That would have to go. American items sold like hotcakes in the garden. I'd expected her to have an instrument case, but there was nothing. Maybe she wasn't a whisperer. There were at least three other strains of sensor she could be. I used my keys to open the red door, which bore a gold plaque reading, "The Lenormand Agency." To the outside world, we were a respectable arts agency. Inside, we were not so honest. At the top of the stairs was Jax, dressed to impress. Silk waistcoat, stiff white collar, shiny pocket watch and glowing cigar. He had a small glass cup of coffee in his hand. I tried and failed to work out how cigar and coffee could make a compatible pair. "Zeke, Nadine, good to see you again." Zeke shook his hand. "And you, Mr. Hull. Welcome to Seven Dials. I am, as you know, Mime Lord of this territory. And you are now members of my elite coterie." Jax was looking at Zeke's face, but I knew his focus was on reading his aura. "I presume you left Gower Street in a surreptitious fashion." "No one saw us." Zeke tensed. "Is that the spirit over there?" Jax glanced behind him. "Yes, that's Peter Klaas, Dutch Vanitas painter, one of our more prolific muses. Died in 1660. Peter, come and meet our new friends." "Zeke can do the honors. I'm tired." Nadine wasn't looking at Peter, who ignored the order. She wasn't sighted. "I want my own room. I don't share my space," she said, looking hard at Jax. "Just so that's settled." I waited to see how Jax would react. He didn't have the most expressive face, but his nostrils flared. Not a good sign. "You will have what you are given," he said. Nadine bristled. Sensing a confrontation, Nick put an arm around her shoulders. "Of course you'll have your own room," he said, giving me a weary look over her head. "We'd have to put Zeke on a couch. Eliza's just sorting it. Can I get you something to drink?" "Yes, you can." She raised her eyebrows at Jax. "I see some Europeans know how to treat a lady." Jackson looked as if she'd slapped him. Nick led her off to the kitchenette. "I am not," he said with gritted teeth. "European." I couldn't help but smile. "I'll make sure nobody disturbs you." "Thank you, Paige." He drew himself up. "Come through to my office, Zeke. We'll talk." Zeke went up the next flight of stairs, still staring at Peter, who was drifting opposite his newest painting. Before I could speak, Jackson took me by the arm. "His dreamscape," he said softly. "What does it feel like?" "Dark," I said, and...
"Excellent. Say no more."
He almost ran up the stairs. His cigar lodged in the corner of his mouth. I was left with three suitcases and a dead artist for company, and as much as I liked Peter, he wasn't a man of many words. I checked the clock. 11:30. Eliza would be back in a few minutes. I made some fresh coffee and went to sit in the living room, where a John William Waterhouse canvas took pride of place. A dark-haired woman in a flowing red dress, gazing into a crystal ball. Jax had paid a lot of money to a trader for three blacklisted Waterhouse paintings. There was a painting of Edward VII, too, decked in his regalia. I opened the window and settled down to read the new pamphlet Jackson was working on the machinations of the itinerant dead. So far it had told me about four kinds of spirit, guardian angel, ghost, muse, and psychopomp. I had yet to read about poltergeists. Eliza wandered in at 12, away with the spirits as usual. She handed me a carton of noodles from Lyle Street. "Hey, don't suppose you persuaded Peter to paint violin and glass ball again?" Eliza Renton was Jax's transmedium, 4 years my senior. Her area of expertise was mime art. Born within striking distance of Bow Bells, she'd worked in an underground theater in the Cut until she was 19, when she responded to Jackson's pamphlet and got hired. She'd been his main source of income ever since. She had clear olive skin and apple-green eyes, and she kept her golden hair in sugar curls. She was never short of admirers. Even spirits loved her. But Jax had a no-commitment policy, and she stuck to it. Not yet. I think he's got artist's block. I put the pamphlet to one side. Met the newcomers? Just met Nadine. Barely got a hello. Eliza flopped down next to me. Are we sure she's a hisser? I cracked open the steaming noodles. I didn't see any instruments, but maybe. Have you seen Zeke? I peeked into the office. His aura is a kind of dark orange. So he's a fury. He doesn't look like a fury. Doesn't seem like he'd say boo to a ghost. She balanced her prawn crackers on her knee. Well, if Peter's being pig-headed, I officially have a window on my schedule. You want to try and drift again? Not until Jax gets the life support. Sure. I think the ventilator's supposed to arrive on Tuesday. We'll take it easy until then. She handed me a sketchbook and a pencil. I meant to ask, could you draw your dreamscape? I took them. Draw it? Yeah. Not the flowers or anything, just the basic shape from a bird's eye view. We're trying to work out the layout of the human dreamscape, but it's tough when none of us can leave our sunlit zones. We think there are at least three zones, but we need you to split up the picture so we can see if our theories work on it. Can you do that? A sense of purpose filled me to the brim. I was proving to be really useful within the group. Of course, I said. Eliza switched on the TV. I set to work on my sketch, drawing a circumpunct surrounded by three rings. The background music for Cy and I floated from the TV set. Scarlett Burnish was reading the midday news. Eliza pointed at the screen, chewing her crackers. Do you think she's actually older than Weaver, but she's had so much surgery that she physically can't develop wrinkles? She smiles too much for that. I continued to sketch. Now I had something that looked more like a bullseye, with five sections. So we've established that this, I tapped the center of the circle, is the sunlit zone. Right. The sunlit zone is where spirits have to remain for a healthy mind. The silver cord is like a safety net. It stops most voids from leaving that zone. But not me. Exactly. That's your personal quirk. Say the majority of us have an inch of string between our body and our spirit, she said, measuring with her fingers. You have a mile. You can walk to the outer ring of your dreamscape, which means you can sense the ether for much farther than we can. You can also sense other dreamscapes. We only sense spirits and aura, and not from very far away. I can't sense Jackson and the others now. I could, but I have a limit. That's why we have to be careful. We don't know your limits yet. You might be able to leave your body, or you might not. We'll have to see. I nodded. Jackson had talked me through his dreamwalker theory several times, but Eliza was a much better teacher. What would happen if you tried to leave your sunlit zone, theoretically? Well, we think that the second zone is where the amaurotic nightmares take place. The cord sometimes lets you get that far if you're stressed or nervous. Beyond that, you start feeling a massive pull back to the center. If you walked beyond the twilight zone, you'd start to go insane. I raised an eyebrow. I really am a freak, aren't I? No, no, Paige. Don't you dare think like that. None of us are freaks. You're a miracle. A jumper. She took the sketchbook from my hands. I'll have Jax check this out once he's finished. He'll love it. Are you staying with your dad tonight? Weren't you going to stay with him on Fridays? I've got to work. Didian thinks he's found William Terrace. Oh, fuck. Say no more. She turned to face me. Hey, you know what they say about the syndicate? Once you get in, you never get out. Sure you're still happy with that? Never been happier. Eliza gave me a smile. It was a strange smile, almost wistful. Okay, she said. I'll be upstairs. Need to pacify Peter. With a jangle of bracelets, she sidled from the room. I started to shade the rings on my sketch, making each one darker than the last. I was still working a few hours later when Jax came down from the second floor. It was getting close to sunset. I'd have to head out and meet Didian soon, but I wanted to transfer my sketch to the computer.
Jack's looked almost feverish.
Jack's?
Unreadable, he breathed.
Oh, my lovely, lovely page. Our dear Mr. Sines is unreadable.
Chapter 21. A Burnt Ship. I will never forget Warden's face when he saw me in the red tunic. It was the first time I ever saw fear in his eyes. It only lasted a split second, but I did see it, just for a moment. A trace of insecurity, softer than a candle flame. He watched me as I headed for my room. Paige. I stopped. How was your inaugural feast?
Enlightening.
I traced the red anchor on the gilet. You were right. She did ask me some questions about you. There was a brief, tense silence. Every muscle in his face was rigid. And you answered them. His voice was cold now. Colder than I'd ever heard it before. What did you tell her? I must know. He wouldn't beg. Warden was proud. His jaw was clenched tight, his lips pressed together in a hard line. I wondered what was racing through his mind. Who to warn, where to run, what to do next. How long could I make him suffer? She did say something that caught my attention. I sat down on the daybed. That the blood consort is forbidden from engaging with the MM.
He is.
Strictly forbidden. His fingers drummed the arm of the chair. You told her about the wounds.
I didn't tell her anything.
His expression changed. After a moment he poured his amaranth from the decanter into a glass.
Then I owe you my life, he said.
You drink a lot of amaranth, I said. Is it for the scars? His gaze flicked up.
Scars?
Yes, the scars. I drink amaranth for my own reasons.
What reasons?
Health reasons, I told you.
Old wounds.
He put the glass back on the table. You chose not to tell Nashira that I have been disobedient. I am intrigued as to why. Betraying people isn't really my style. I didn't miss his evasion. Scars and old wounds were the same thing.
I see.
Warden looked into the empty hearth. So you withheld information from Nashira, but you have been given a red tunic.
You recommended it.
I did, but I did not know if she would agree. I suspect she has ulterior motives. I have an external assignment tomorrow.
The Citadel, he conjectured.
That is surprising.
Why?
After all the effort she expended to procure you from the Citadel, it seems strange that she should send you back. She wants me to lure out one of the London gangs, the Seven Seals. She thinks they have a dreamwalker, that I can recognize one of my own.
I waited, but he didn't react.
Did he suspect me? We leave tomorrow night with three red jackets and one other Rephite.
Who?
Your cousin.
Ah, yes.
He pressed his fingertips together. Sichula Mazatum is Nashira's most trusted mercenary. You and I must be cautious around her.
So you're going to treat me like your slave again?
A necessary but temporary situation. Sichula is no friend of mine. She will have been assigned to keep an eye on me.
Why?
Past transgressions.
He caught my look.
It is better that you know nothing about it. All you should know is that I do not kill unless it is absolutely necessary.
Past transgressions. Old wounds. That could only mean one thing, and we both knew it.
But it still didn't guarantee he could be trusted now. Even if he was a scarred one.
I need to get some sleep, I said.
We meet at her residence tomorrow at dusk.
Warden nodded, not looking at me.
I picked up my boots and went to my room, leaving him to drink his remedy. For most of the day, while I should have been asleep, I thought of every possible scenario that could occur when we reached London. The plan, according to the post-dinner briefing, was to wait until Carter reached the base of Nelson's Column, where she would meet with a representative from the SEALs. We would surround them, then strike with everything we had. She seemed to think we'd just walk in there, shoot Carter, grab some prisoners and waltz back to Sheol One in time for the day bell.
I knew better. I knew Jax.
He protected his investments. He would never send a lone representative to meet Antoinette. The whole gang would be there. Vigilés staked out the streets during the night,
and they knew how to use basic spirit combat. We would also have the public to contend with, and with Voyants on the street, we could end up with a very big fight on our hands. A fight in which I would be dressed for one side, but rooting for the other. I turned over, restless. This was my chance to escape, or at least to get word out. Somehow I had to reach Nick, if he didn't kill me first, or blind me with his visions. It was my one and only window of opportunity. I gave up on sleep in the end. I went to the bathroom, splashed my face, and pulled my hair into a psyche knot. It had grown a few inches down to my shoulders. Rain pounded at the windows. I dressed in the same uniform, the red trader's tunic, and went down to the chamber. The grandfather clock told me it was close to 7. I took a seat by the fire. When the hour struck, Warden appeared at the door, his hair and clothes drenched with rain. "It is time." I nodded. He let me through the door, locked it, and walked with me down the stone steps. "I never thanked you," he said as we went through the cloisters. "For your silence. Don't thank me yet." The streets were silent. Melting hailstones crunched beneath my boots. When we reached the residence, 2 refs escorted us to the library where Nishira was waiting. She and Warden reenacted their ritual greeting, his hand on her stomach, her lips to his forehead. This time I noticed things. The rigidity of his movements, how he never met her eyes, how she ran her fingers through his hair, not looking at him. It put me in mind of a dog and its mistress. "I am pleased you could both join us tonight," she said, like we had a choice. 40. This is Sichula Mazatim. Sichula was almost as tall as Warden. You could see the family resemblance. Same ash-brown hair, same honey skin, same strong features and deep-set eyes. She nodded to Warden, who was still kneeling. "Cousin." Warden inclined his head. Sichula turned her eyes on me. "Blue. 2059-40. You will treat me as your second keeper this evening. I hope that is understood." I nodded. Warden stared and looked down at his fiancé. "Where are the other humans?" "Getting ready, of course." She turned her back on him. "You ought to do the same, my faithful one." His aura clouded over, like a storm was brewing in his dreamscape. He turned and walked towards a heavy set of crimson drapes. An Amarotic girl hurried after him, carrying a bundle of clothes. "You will be paired with one," Nishira said to me. "The 2 of you will go with Arcturus. Sichula will take 30 and 12. David emerged from behind the drapes, wearing black trousers, boots, and a lightweight vest of body armor. The sight of him made me start. He looked exactly like the overseer on the night he shot me. "Evening 40, he said. I kept my mouth shut. David smiled and shook his head, as if I were an amusing child. An Amarotic approached me. "Your clothes." "Thank you." Without looking at David, I took my bundle to the drapes. Behind them was a tent, a dressing room of sorts. I shucked my uniform and donned the new one. First a long-sleeved red shirt, then the armor, marked with the red anchor like the gilet, and a black jacket with a red band on one sleeve. Next came glovelets and trousers, both made of a flexible black fabric and sturdy leather boots. I could run, climb, fight in this attire. There was a syringe of adrenaline in the jacket, and a flux gun, for hunting Voyants. Once I was kitted out, I returned to where the other 3 humans had gathered. Carl gave me a smile. "Hello, 40. "Carl," I said. "How are you finding your new tunic?" "It fits, if that's what you mean." "No, I mean, how are you finding being a red jacket?" All 3 of them were staring at me now. "Great," I said, after a pause. Carl nodded. "It is great. Maybe they were right to give you so many privileges." "Or maybe they were wrong," 30 said, pulling her thick hair from her collar. She was taller than me, wide in the hips and shoulders. "We'll find out on the streets." I took another look at 30. From her aura, I guessed she was probably a soothsayer, but a less common one, maybe a type of cleromancer. Not particularly rare. She must have clawed her way up the ranks. Yes, I said. We will. She sniffed. Warden's return had a stunning effect on 30's demeanor. She bobbed a delicate little curtsy, murmuring, "That consort." At her side, Carl swept into a bow. I just stood there with my arms crossed. Warden glanced at his fan club, but didn't acknowledge either of their tributes. Instead, he looked across the room. At me. 30 looked chagrined. Poor old 30. New clothes had transformed my keeper. In place of the old-fashioned Rephite regalia, he wore the clothes of a wealthy Scion denizen, the sort no clever thief would try to find wire. You will be taken to one cohort in two collection vehicles, Nishira said. Traffic will be cleared for you. You are expected to return here before the day bell rings. We four humans nodded. Warden shrugged on his coat and turned towards the door. 2040, 21, he called. Carl looked like November tide had come early. He ran after Warden, shoving his flux gun into his jacket as he went. I was about to follow him when Nishira caught my arm in her gloved hand. I held very still, resisting the urge to pull away. I know who you are, she said, close to my face. I know where you come from. If you do not bring back a dreamwalker, I will assume that I am correct, and that you are the pale dreamer. That realization will have consequences for us all. With a look that made me cold, she turned her back on me and walked towards the doors. Have a safe journey, 2059-40. Two blacked-out vehicles were waiting on the bridge. They blindfolded all four of us before they locked us in. I sat in the darkness with Carl, listening to the engine. They must have a nagging fear that we'd learn the route out of the colony. A team of vigilantes had been dispatched to escort us through the borders, but the procedure for letting people out of Sheol 1 was complicated. The city was a penal colony, and it was just as much hassle as if prisoners were out on parole. We had tracking chips shot under our skin at one of Scion's outer city substations, just in case we tried to make a run for it. And our fingerprints and auras were examined. They took a tube of my blood, leaving a smudge of bruise at the crease of my elbow. Finally, we crossed the last border, and we were back in Scion London. Back in the real world. You may remove your blindfolds, Warden said. I couldn't get rid of mine fast enough. Oh, my citadel. I traced the glass, the blue lights glowing into my eyes. The car was rolling through White City in 2-3, past the mammoth shopping complex. I'd never thought I'd miss the dirty gunmetal streets. But I did. I missed bidding on spirits and playing taroki, and climbing up buildings with Nick to watch the sun sink. I wanted to get out of the car and throw myself into London's poisoned heart. Carl had been jittery for the journey, bouncing his knee and fiddling with his flux gun, but he dropped off to sleep on the motorway. He had told me that 30 used to be called Amelia, and that her keeper was one Elnath Theron. As I'd guessed, she was a cleromancer, with a particular gift for dice. It took me a while to remember the exact word. Astrogolomancer. I was getting rusty. Jax had once examined me daily on the 7 orders of clairvoyance. I looked again at Carl. His hair needed a wash. From the circles etched under his eyes, I knew he was as tired as I was, but there were no bruises. More betrayals must have earned his safety. As if he sensed me looking, he opened his eyes. Don't try and escape. He whispered it. When I didn't answer, he shifted up to me. They won't let you go. He won't. He glanced at Warden through the glass screen. Sheol is safe for us. Why would you want to leave? Because we don't belong there. It's the one place we do belong. We can be clairvoyant there. We don't have to hide. You're not an idiot, Carl. You know it's a prison. And the Citadel isn't? No, it isn't. Carl looked back at his gun. I looked back at the window. Part of me knew what he meant. Of course the Citadel was a prison. Scion kept us locked in there like animals. But we didn't stand by in the Citadel and watch other people get beaten up, or let people die on the streets. I pressed my head against the glass. That wasn't true. Hector did. Jackson did. Every mime lord and mime queen in the citadel did. They only rewarded those who were useful. The rest were thrown out to rot. But the gang were like my family. I didn't have to bow to anyone in the citadel. I was Molisher of 1-4. I had a name. Soon we were in Marylebone. As Warden looked out at the unfamiliar territory of the citadel, I wondered if he'd been to London before. He must have if he'd met previous inquisitors. It chilled me that refs had been on the streets at the same time I was. They'd been in the Archon, even in 1-4. The driver was a silent, robust man, in wire-framed spectacles and a suit, with a red silk pocket square and tie. He wore a dictaphone on his left ear, which beeped every so often. It was morbidly fascinating to see how organized it was. Sion had all its bases covered. Nobody could find out about Sheol 1. It was a city under lock and key. Warden motioned for the driver to stop on a street corner. The man nodded and ducked out of the car. When he returned, he was carrying a large paper bag. Warden passed it to me through the hatch. "Wake him." He nodded to Carl, who was asleep again. Inside the bag were two hot cartons from Brekkabox, the Citadel's favourite fast food joint. I prodded Carl. "Rise and shine." Carl came round with a jolt. I opened my box and found a breakfast wrap, a serviette, and a pot of porridge. I caught Warden's eye in the rear view mirror, and he gave me the barest nod of acknowledgement. I looked away. The car passed into Section 4. My section. My scalp prickled with sweat. My father lived only 20 minutes from here, and we were getting close to Seven Dials. Too close. I half expected to receive something from Nick, but there was total silence in the ether. Several hundred dreamscapes pressed against mine, distracting me from meat space. When I focused on the nearest view, I sensed nothing unusual. No fresh waves of emotion. These people had no inkling of the Rephaim or the penal colony. They didn't care where unnaturals went, just as long as they were out of sight. Our car stopped in the Strand, where a vigilante was waiting for us. The ones they put on duty all looked pretty much the same. Tall, broad-shouldered, typically mediums. I avoided the man's eyes as I stepped from the car, leaving the empty breakfast cartons under the seat. Warden, being huge and formidable, was not in the least bit nervous. "Good evening, Vigilay." "Warden." The Vigilay touched three fingers to his forehead, one at the center and one above each eye, then raised his hand in a salute. It was an official sign of his clairvoyance, of his third eye. "Can I confirm you have Carl Dempsey Brown and Paige Mahoney in your custody?" "Confirmed." "Identification numbers?" 2059-1 and 40, respectively. The Jilly made a note of it. I wondered what had made him turn his back on his own kind. A cruel mime lord, perhaps. "You two should remember that you are in custody. You are here to assist the Rephaim. You will be sent straight back to Sheol 1 when your assignment is complete. If either of you attempts to broadcast Sheol 1's location, you will be shot. If either of you attempts to make contact with the general public, or with any member of the syndicate, you will be shot. If either of you attempts to harm your keeper, or a vigilay, you will be shot. Do I make myself clear?" Well, he'd made it pretty damn clear that whatever we did, we were going to be shot. "We understand," I said. But the vigilay wasn't quite finished. He unpacked a silver tube and a pair of latex gloves from his supply belt. "Not another needle." "You fast." He grabbed me by the wrist. "Open your mouth." "What?" "Open your mouth." I wanted to look at Warden, but I knew from his silence that he had no objections to this procedure. Before I could comply, the Jilly prized my mouth open. I wanted to bite the bastard. He scraped the plastic nib over my lips, coating them in something cold and bitter. "Shut it." With no other choice, I closed my mouth. When I tried to open it again, I couldn't. My eyes widened. "Shit." "Just a spot of dermal adhesive." The Jilly pulled Carl towards him. "Wears off after 2 or 3 hours. We're not taking any chances, seeing as all you Cindys know each other." "But I'm not..." Carl started. "Shut up." And at last Carl was forced to shut up. 1949-30 isn't glued.
Look at her for orders, the Jilly said. Otherwise, stick to your objectives. I pushed my tongue against my lips, but they wouldn't budge. This Jilly must love having won over an ex-syndicate members. Having sealed our mouths, the Jilly saluted Warden before he returned to the stern grey building he'd emerged from. There was a plaque outside. The Cyan Citadel of London, NVD Command Post, 1 Cohort, Section 4, with a map of the area covered by that post. I could make out a marker for the shopping centre in Covent Garden, the pot under which the black market bubbled. If only I could get there. Maybe I still could. Carl swallowed. Even though we had been seeing these plaques for years, they were still daunting. I looked up at Warden. Sichula and her humans will approach the square from the western side, he said. Are you ready? I don't know how he expected us to answer. Carl nodded. Warden reached into his jacket and procured 2 masks. Here, he said, handing one to each of us. These will disguise your identities. These were no ordinary masks. They had blank, uniform features, with small eye holes and slots for air below the nose. When I fitted mine to my face, it bonded to my skin. It wouldn't earn a second glance from busy Cyan denizens, but it would also stop the gang from recognizing me, and with my lips sealed, I couldn't call for help. How clever it all was. Warden looked at me for a moment before he put his own mask on. Eerie light burned in the eye holes. For the first time, I was glad I was fighting on his side. We walked towards Nelson's column. Like the dials, the monument, and most other columns, it turned red or green depending on the security situation. Currently it was green, as were the fountains. A team of Jillies was on patrol, stationed at regular intervals down the Strand, probably having been ordered to back us up if necessary. They shot us guarded looks as we passed, but none of them moved. They all carried M4 carbines. The NVD didn't broadcast their true purpose in the city, but everyone knew they were more than police. You didn't approach a night Jilly with a complaint, not like you might an SVD officer. You approached only in dire circumstances, and never if you were voyant. Even Amarotics didn't like to go near them. After all, they were unnaturals. Carl kept flexing his fingers in his pockets. How could I get out of this without killing any of my gang? There must be some way I could show them who I was. I had to warn them, or they'd join me in the penal colony. I couldn't let Nashira get them. Trafalgar Square was artificially lit, but it was dark enough for us to remain inconspicuous. Sichula, Amelia, and David were approaching from the other side. The 3 of them disappeared behind one of the 4 bronze lion statues that guarded Nelson's column. Warden leaned down to my level. Carter will arrive soon, he said, keeping his voice low. We must bide our time until she makes contact with the seal. Do not allow yourselves to be captured under any circumstances. Carl nodded. Once the area is clear, the NVD will escort us back to the vehicle. You will cease and desist if the seals leave the boundaries of 1 cohort. I was starting to sweat. 7 dials was well within 1 cohort. If the gang tried to make it back to base, they could find themselves being tailed there. Big Ben was 2 minutes from striking. Warden sent Carl to sit on the steps of the column. As a soothsayer, he was the least conspicuous. Once he was settled, Warden led me past the fountain to one of the statue plinths. There were 7 of them, 1 for each of the people who had facilitated the establishment and continuation of Cyan: Palmerston, Salisbury, Asquith, MacDonald, Zettler, Mayfield, Weaver. The 7th plinth always bore the likeness of the ruling inquisitor, along with his or her motto. Warden stopped behind a statue. He studied my masked face. Forgive me, he said. I did not know you would be silenced. I gave no sign that I'd heard him. I had to concentrate on breathing through my nose. Do not look yet. Carter is waiting at the base of the column, as planned. I didn't want to do this. I wanted to get Antoinette out of here. I wanted to burst into her dreamscape to make her run away. And then I sensed them. It was them, no doubt about it. They were approaching from all different directions.
Jax must have mobilized the entire gang, all six of the remaining seals. Would he recognize my aura straight away, or would he presume there was just another dreamwalker, a tiny chance, in the vicinity? I sense a medium, Warden said, and a whisperer. Eliza and Nadine. I looked out at the base of Nelson's column, and yes, there was Antoinette. She wore a frock coat and a wide-brimmed black hat. Strands of graying red hair fell past her ears. What little of her face I could see bore crevices that had been airbrushed out of the TV show. Between her fingers was a silver cigarette holder, fitted to a roll of what looked like purple aster. She had some gall. No one smoked ethereal drugs in public. The idea of doing battle with Tony Carter was enough to make me sick with nerves. On her show, she would often have a violent seizure prior to making a prediction, a perk that had blown the ratings through the roof. I could only imagine how she might fight. Nick denounced the idea that she was an oracle. Oracles never lost control like that. Nadine came first. She wore a pinstriped blazer, loosely buttoned. No doubt it hid a set of irons. The others all appeared one by one, though they gave no hint that they knew one another. Only their auras linked them. When I caught sight of Nick, I thought I would burst. Into tears, into laughter, into song. He was heavily disguised. Had to be, given his glittering cyan career. His hair was covered by a dark wig and a hat, and he wore tinted glasses. A few feet away, Jax was tapping his cane. At my side, Warden remained silent. His eyes darkened when one of his targets edged closer to Antoinette. Eliza had been chosen to go forward. Close behind her was Danny, her mouth set in a grim line. She was disguised too. Had it been me, I would have made initial contact with Antoinette with one of my nudges to check the coast was clear. But Eliza had no such power. The ether screwed with her, not the other way around. She lifted four fingers of her right hand, three of her left, and ran them through her hair, as if she was checking for knots. Antoinette understood. She stepped towards Eliza and extended a hand. Eliza took it. Cetula struck first. Faster than I could register, she was on top of Antoinette, strangling her. Warden made towards Zeke, just as Carl sent a nearby spirit hurtling towards Eliza. It must have been Nelson, the most powerful spirit in the square. Eliza crumpled against one of the lions, clutching her chest, and cried out in a strangled voice, "I cannot command winds and weather, nor can I command myself in death." Amelia flew out next, only to be tackled by an enraged Nick, who had seen Eliza's pain before anything else. David took Jax, or tried to take Jax. Danny swung her fist at him, knocking a spurt of blood from his mouth. In less than 10 seconds, I was the only one who had not yet come out to fight. That suited me. It did not suit Jackson. He saw me at once, another masked enemy. He drew up a spool of six and hurled it in my direction. I had to move, and fast. The spirits of Trafalgar could pose a serious threat. I sent a flux dart at him, but aimed well above his head. Jack still ducked, sending the spool scattering all over the place. "Give it up," I thought. "Don't make me attack you." But Jackson never gave up. He was livid. We'd spoiled his plans. He lunged at me, wielding his cane. I tried to land a kick to his stomach, to push him back, but I didn't do it hard enough. He grabbed my ankle, and with a flex of his arms he flipped me over. Pain. "Move, move." Not fast enough. Jax drove his steel-capped boot into my side, kicking me onto my back. His knee crashed down on my chest. His fist flew, a blur. Then something solid struck the unprotected part of my face. Knuckle duster. And again in the ribs. Something cracked, and it hurt. And again, I swung up my arm to block a fourth punch. His eyes were gleaming, hot with bloodlust. Jax was going to kill me. I had no choice. With my body pinned, I used my spirit. He wasn't expecting that. He wasn't concentrating on my aura. The thump against his dreamscape made him fall.